Thanks for tuning into my new show, Get U.S. Market Ready with Italian Wine People. I'm Steve Ray, author of the book, How to Get U.S. Market Ready. And in my previous podcast, I shared some of the lessons I've learned from 30 years in the wine and spirits business, helping brands enter and grow in the U.S. market. This series will be dedicated to the personalities who have been working in the Italian wine sector in the U.S., their experiences, challenges, and personal stories. I'll uncover the roads that they walked, shedding light on current trends, business strategies, and their unique brands. So, thanks for listening in, and let's get to the interview.
Before the show, here's a shout out to our new sponsor, Ferro Wine. Ferro Wine has been the largest wine shop in Italy since 1920. They have generously supplied us with our new t-shirt. Would you like one? Just donate 50 euros and it's all yours. Plus, we'll throw in our new book, Jumbo Shrimp Guide to International Grape Varieties in Italy. For more info, go to italianwinepodcast.com and click donate, or check out Italian Wine Podcast on Instagram.
Welcome. This is Steve Ray, and welcome to this week's edition of Get U.S. Market Ready with Italian Wine People. Today, I'm pleased to have as a guest Melanie Offenlock, who I was surprised to meet on a trip once in Italy to find out that she was the Dallas Wine Chick blogger that I had been reading for a couple of years. And I never put two and two together until we kind of met in person, and it was, oh, you're Dallas Wine Chick, which was kind of a fun thing. Anyway, Melanie, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do and why you do what you do.
Absolutely. Well, that's so flattering, Steve. I was thrilled to meet you too after communicating for so long virtually. I have been blogging for, gosh, about 12 years now. I am not a paid wine person in any capacity. I've been running my own marketing consulting firm, actually working with tech companies, and I'm the acting chief marketing officer for a company by the name of Icon Science. So wine really has been a passion and a love, and a lot of times a weekend thing where I actually write the blog and get it out. And you know, it's something that I want to make sure that I continue to tell my story of wine, which is, as you know, the story of so many others as I learn my way through the process.
12 years ago, what made you start to write a wine blog, and what was your level of wine interest and knowledge? I can't even count back 12 years ago. Was that like 2009? Yes, 2009.
Well, we're 2021. So, you know, honestly, it was really working for someone early in my career that I called Sleepy Ed. And Sleepy Ed would sit in his corner office and he would read the Wall Street Journal. And none of us who were working with him actually knew what he did. I still don't know what he did to this day. And, you know, all of these social media platforms and new things were coming down the pike. And here I sat working for a large PR conglomerate, and I had a chance of becoming Sleepy Ed in my corner office if I didn't learn, you know, Twitter and, you know, to a lesser extent, Facebook and all the other things that were really going to change the way that we communicate. And so I got on Twitter and I was the generic Melanie Zero. I started talking about marketing, and I looked back about 45 days later, and the people that followed me, was 40 something of them, they all reported directly either into me or into one of my direct reports. You know, there was nothing social about that. There was nothing that was, you know, representative of what social media was about. So I decided it was time to pivot. And I started talking about wine, and I told my husband, and I have no idea where this number came from, that I had to hit, I think it was 1600 followers, and somehow I did. And I found this engaged wine community and decided that I'd start a blog right around, I think it was my very first Wine Bloggers Conference, which was in Washington back in, gosh, 2010, and that's how the train got rolling.
And what was your level of wine knowledge at the time? Why wine?
You know, I was very enthusiastic. We went to a lot of, my husband and I went to a lot of tastings and a lot of, you know, different events to try to learn more. I, you know, am not an expert. I'm still not an expert 12 years later. I just have developed that passion.
Okay, I'm going to push you on this. Why wine?
You can never know enough. And I love the challenge. Every time that I learn something or I feel like I have accomplished learning of a certain region or a certain variety or, you know, certain terroir, I find out there are 100 more things that, or 1,000 more things that I have to learn, and I know nothing. And I love that.
Yeah. And it's all stories. Okay. So you started 12 years ago. Now you're in it 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year, 2 years. At some point in that time period, you must have thought, wow, how long am I going to keep this thing up?
Yes. You know, there are times where you wonder, does anybody read it? Does all of this work, will it make an impact? Because, you know, it takes a lot of work. I know people think it's if they don't know, oh, she's just running around going on trips, having a fantastic time. And, you know, a lot of times you're working harder than you may work because you may have a 19-hour day where you're expected to figure out time zones and expected to figure out how to get back to the hotel and get something posted because that's the expectation of the people that are hosting you. You have this job that you have to check in on and make sure that everything is still going as well. So, you know, there are times where I get off a plane and my husband just looks at me. He's like, I thought you were on a fun wine trip.
Right. But I don't think we're going to get any sympathy for working 19 hours a day on a wine trip when we're going to like 3 wineries a day and meeting some of the most interesting people in the world and drinking the most interesting wines, seeing the most interesting and beautiful places and having wonderful food and conversation.
Absolutely not.
So we're not going to ask for that. But you kept going. So now it's 12 years later. And there are really very few people who have done what you've done. I mean, I was involved with the Bloggers Conference from the very beginning and am a blogger myself, but not to the extent that you are. I'm doing much more of the business of wine. But you've kept at it for all this time. How do you keep yourself motivated?
You know, it's something that I have to do by Sunday at midnight. And a lot of times it's a Saturday, Sunday project. Obviously, I have my interviews and my stories done, or at least written down of what I want to talk about long before that. But it really is a passion. You know, when I used to have my global job before I started my consulting business, and I was on plane for, in some cases, you know, 15, 16 hours trying to get to the destination where I needed to be, it brought me joy to unplug and to write about wine.
Okay, so how much time do you think you have to spend to do a blog post from the beginning of, focusing on that one, prepping, outlining, writing, and then posting?
Gosh, it takes a lot of time. I'd say 8 to 12 hours at a minimum. If you're really diving in, by the time you do your interview, you taste the wines, you take your notes, you do your research. And I'm probably being conservative.
Okay. I certainly believe that because I know how long it takes to prep and do this whole podcast. But so you talked about tasting. So what is the focus of the blog? Is it about tasting wines and your discovery of learning about wines? Or
it's really about the story of wine and the story of the people behind the wine. You know, there's so many places that you can go to get a rating or to get an opinion. You know, I certainly have my opinion. You've known me for a long time, Steve, but there are some people that want me to tell them, you know, what is a good red. And I'm happy to do those review columns a couple of times a year, but I'm not going to rate wines. I'm not a wine expert. You know, wine is a lot like art, and you may, you know, love a piece of art on your wall. Some people don't know why they like it. They just know they like it. And, you know, wine for a lot of people is seen in the same way as art is. A good wine is one that you like. A bad one is one that you don't, no matter what anybody tells you, right?
I like that. Because, you know, one of the things that we see on these trips and everything else is this vocabulary that comes with it of, you know, hints of this and after notes of this, you know, fried gooseberries and chopped walnut shells and smoked pineapple husks. And, you know, I never heard of any of those things. And they don't mean anything to me. I mean, I've said this before, my philosophy of what people want to know about wine is, what does it taste like in words I understand? And will it go with what I'm having for dinner tonight? Those two things, for the most part. Now, those who want to go deeper into the story behind the wine may be more interested in maybe just a couple of factoids, as opposed to the in-depth lectures that we get to, and I say get to go to, have the pleasure of going to, where they go deep into soil characteristics and glaciation and prevailing winds and weather patterns and, you know, all that kind of stuff. When you do your notes, when you do your evaluations, what kind of vocabulary do you use?
I try to keep it more simplistic than on the upper end. There are some words that weave your way into the vocabulary that I probably use a little more consistently than I should, because it's the first thing that associates when I try it, right?
Which is usually going to be acid, tannins, and fruit on the nose, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, I have one of the great tasting kits that have all the different vials that you can smell.
Cool. And you use that as a way to codify what you're doing?
Sometimes. I'd say I would like to be more disciplined about it. But I do try to take that out regularly and smell it and try to reacquaint my senses with some new things, especially if I'm drinking a wine I haven't had in a while.
So when you're tasting a wine, what are you looking for? Obviously, do I like it? Do I not like it? But you're going to be writing about it and going to be sharing some information with other people. What are the things that you look for and want to, the categories that you want to tell people about? Well, this wine is this.
I think you're always looking for balance, right? You're always looking for what is this a representation of what this wine is supposed to be based upon the region that it's from. I'm looking a lot of times for regions I don't know much about. Like I got to taste some Armenian wine earlier this year, and that was a really cool discovery for me, because I hadn't had it. I really didn't know much about the region, and it's one of the oldest wine regions. And, that was one of my aha moments. And I really enjoy the journey of finding new things that I know nothing about.
So talk about what places you've been, either in real life that you've actually had the chance to visit, and those that you've explored in your own pursuit of wine knowledge. Start with the places you've been, because that's where we met.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, I've been several places in Italy, including Venitaly, which is, if you haven't either seen or experienced Venitaly, it is the second largest trade show of wine out there.
No, actually, I think it's the largest.
It's the largest now. Ah.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. And you can tell just because it takes you about an hour and a half to get from building one to building 15.
Yes. It is football fields of wine. I've obviously been there. I've been to Tuscany. I've been to Trento. I've been to four or five different regions in Spain. I've been to, now I'm having a senior moment, to, I think, all of the wine regions in the U.S. Next on my list at the very top is going to be Croatia.
That's kind of sitting out there for me as well. A funny story talking about people reading you and you not knowing that they're reading you. Or one day I came home and there was a package, UPS package, and it was a whole sampler of Rieslings and cabs from Croatia. There was a guy who was thinking about introducing a product to the U.S. He had heard one of my presentations where I said I really love Riesling, and not only was he doing they make Rieslings, and he sent them to me, and I thought, wow, how cool is that? Like, either stalkers or lurkers, which is a nice way to say about it. But I think back to your point, there's a whole bunch of people who you're making an impact on that, you know, don't get any reaction from. But when it does come up, I'll often say something. They'll say, yeah, you know, I read what you wrote. What? Really? There's somebody out there who's reading it. So you're having an impact. Have you had much feedback from your listeners like that?
You know, I have. I think the funniest moment was I was in a Whole Foods in Dallas, and someone walked up to me and said, are you the Dallas Wine Chick? And my 14-year-old was like, who is that? I'm like, I don't know. And she's like, how does that person know you, Mom? That's so weird. She was not amused. It was funny.
What are the areas in Italy? So you've been to a couple. I think we were both on a trip to Trento Dock, which was astonishing to me because of the altitude that they grow the grapes at. It's up at about 3,000 feet, 1,000 meters or so. And the aging for like 8-9 years, as opposed to 2 or 3 that many other sparkling wine regions do. But what other regions in Italy are you interested in are discovering?
Oh, gosh. You know what? I have gotten this year so many Zoom tastings in different regions of Italy. I have to say, there's so many small places. If you give me a minute, I can go back to my blog and tell you what I did, but I am so impressed. You know, lots of places that are near water, by the ocean, have this interesting terroir. Lots of families that needed to get the word on the street out about their wineries because they obviously couldn't get it to the U.S. and they needed us to write about it to make sure that they remained afloat. You know, just really, really cool, you know, places. And give me a moment and I'll tell you one of the ones that really stuck out to me that I am bound and determined I'm going to get on a plane and go to when we're allowed to roam around the country again, because it was such a cool experience. Erpinia, let's see. Campania in Montefalcone.
The wines that are down there are, I believe, like Aglianico, Taurasi, Cota di Volpe. Is that what you're talking about?
Let's see. This was Fino di Avellino. Taurasi and Greco di Tufo.
Greco di Tufo and Fiano d'Avellino. Yeah. We actually used to import Mastro Berardino, which I think is imported now by Taub Family Selections. And have you ever been to Pompeii?
I have not. It was on my list to go to last year.
Yeah, well, how'd that work out for you?
Yeah. I pretty much didn't go not far beyond this door last year.
I mention it because the Mastro Berardino family goes back really old, hundreds and hundreds of years, and maybe even more than hundreds. But they have planted or replanted a vineyard in the Pompeii historical zone of wines that were grown there and are making wines like the Romans in the Romans in Pompeii drank when they were there, which is totally awesome. And I think you can get some of it here in the U.S. I'll look into that for you. But what a wonderful story. So not only do you get to see Pompeii, the beauty of that is you get to see it as people, you know, as it was with all the, you know, artwork on the walls. And they have the wine shops on every corner with the holes dug out and where the amphora would sit. And people would walk by and just get a dipper full of wine. And now Mastro's making that wine with many of those grapes that you just mentioned, Cota di Volpe and so forth.
And Laguna is really another find this year. I was really, really impressed by the sparklings and the stills that I got to try. And I even got to try a red, which was pretty amazing.
Lugana? Oh, I think you said Laguno.
Oh, I thought it might be my southern accent.
Yeah, it could be Lugana. Yeah, from the other side of Lake Garda from the Veneto.
Correct.
So one of the other things you had made a point when we were originally having a conversation is the impact that the Black Lives Matter movement and the George Floyd case had on you and recognition of, I guess the key word these days is equity and diversity, and how that's impacted what you're writing about.
Absolutely. Well, when George Floyd happened, I made a personal pledge that I was going to not only write more about Black winemakers, but try to incorporate them more into my stories that were more general in nature, where, as you know, as a journalist, sometimes you just go to your ongoing sources and ask the same people because you know they'll respond, you know it'll be timely. And I have been well rewarded with branching out and getting some amazing new people in my contact list. And, you know, it's been something that we as writers have to make sure that we hold ourselves accountable, we hold others accountable. And, you know, there's a big movement right now in the wine industry with you know, giving a voice to people that haven't had it in a long time, whether that be in diversity, whether that be the Me Too movement. And it really is time for people to be accountable and to step up and to stop hiding, you know, behind this cloak of secrecy and to do the right thing.
But the reality of the situation is most of the people in the wine industry are Caucasian, just because of the history of Europe and the United States. So it's one thing to recognize that. It's another thing, I think, to advocate for it. One of the things I was pleased to see the other day, Diageo just set up a fund for, call them diversity-based businesses in the wine and spirits industry. And the same point you made, which is the recognition, and more than the recognition, is empowering them and funding them to be able to get in and participate, which you're right. And I think, you know, that applies not just to color of your skin, but it also happens to sexual orientation. It has to gender alone and all kinds of other things. You had mentioned one thing I thought was really great. I was probing in our original conversation about this blog that stories can change you. And you had mentioned Chapelet. And can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So I had the opportunity to meet with Cyril Chapelet a couple of years ago. And it was at a point that I was thinking about leaving the corporate world and starting my own consulting firm or doing something else. So we had a one-on-one lunch and, you know, talked about the plans for the winery and, you know, was just a really engaging, great guy. And somehow I looked down at my watch. We had been there close to 3 hours. I was disclosing to him my desire to leave the corporation where I headed up marketing and, you know, what I was going to do next and getting his advice and just really found this amazing connection with him where he gave me, you know, some advice on how to handle it and what to do, and just some really sage advice on the next step for making this decision. And I'm eternally grateful to him. I have told him this when we run into each other again, but I don't know if he knows the impact that he had on me personally. And I was just there to write the story about Chapelet.
Oh, great. Okay. So there's a shift gears a little bit and put your marketing hat back on because that's where you really live. And give me some comments on what you see as the state of effectiveness and sophistication of marketing as practiced in the wine industry in the United States. And then after that, maybe we can talk about e-commerce. But start with generally your perspective from a tech point of view on how the wine industry operates.
I think with the pandemic, people realized that they had to do some upgrading if they were going to survive. Historically, the wine industry has been very behind in using marketing as a tool to retain customers the way that I think any other industry would do so.
That was very politely stated. Yeah.
There's a lot of fear, right? They don't, a lot of winemakers or farmers, they don't understand technology, but you see the power when it's done well. And when the right customers are targeted with the right messages, it does lead to revenue. And clearly I am a big fan of of marketing. It's what I do. I've, you know, live and die by the ROI. And I wish that marketers would be incorporated more into winery decisions.
I personally am seeing a lot more of it. And I think a lot of it is being driven by e-commerce and the need to pivot, if you will, from the traditional ways of doing things to electronic ways of doing things. And along with that comes the advance in technology in CRM, customer relationship management, customer acquisition type programs, who's in control of the relationship between the customer and the brand. Often it's the retailer, but we've got all these third party elements coming in, which are changing the equation a little bit. So I've heard people say, you know, we've come 10 years in 10 months. Well, that was back about 6 months ago when the pandemic was before we had the vaccines. But the problem is, I was just listening to a podcast today about it from Avalara and Silicon Valley Bank, is because of the regulatory issues surrounding the beverage alcohol industry and 52 different regulatory entities controlling it, it's very difficult to apply technology that is universally applicable in a market that has 52 different flavors.
Right. Absolutely. And you know, there's so much confusion just moving from place to place. I told a story today on my blog about meeting with Remy Cohen, who's the new CEO for Domaine Canaris. And we met at a seafood restaurant where we were going to taste wines from her old position, which was supposed to be paired with oysters. And in Texas, you can't bring any wines in that are not on the list. And so we had oysters and Cabernet instead.
And how was it?
You know, it was not as bad as you would think. It's a great story, but that's how we became, our friendship started. So,
well, let me turn that around. Okay. So if you had your druthers, what would you drink with oysters?
A lovely Chablis or Montrachet or a great champagne. So many great things to drink with oysters.
Yeah. Have you had Muscadet and oysters?
I have. That's another great choice.
Yeah, it's one of those spectacular things that when is one of the things that just go together. I found that in Greece too, a Certico from Santorini with lobster that's been freshly fished out and beaten on a rock. It's just kind of a remarkable pairing of things that go together. That's kind of the way to think about it.
Totally agree.
So let's bring this to a close and talk about, I had mentioned that I like to end with, what's the one big takeaway? If people are listening to this who maybe aren't telling me who they are or you, is there anything they can apply from what you've learned or learned about by doing your blog or talked about in today's conversation that they could put to use immediately in the industry?
Absolutely. I think if you have an interest in writing a blog or writing or telling stories or podcasting or doing YouTube, that you just need to get started. You just need to get it out there, and you will evolve a lot over the time that you do it. And that's expected and okay. And people will support you. You'll be surprised how engaged people will become with you if you just put it out there.
That reminds me of a story, a great point. I'll tell you how old this is. It was a former creative director of mine when I worked on an ad agency. And he said, writing's easy. You just put a piece of paper in the typewriter. There's the dating it part. And he says, and then you open a vein. And you know, when they say it's from the heart, literally in that particular case. But that's what it is you're putting yourself out there, exposing yourself for all the world to see and, you know, read and judge maybe. And that's it's a hard thing to do. But when you do and it impacts people, as you talked about with Chapel A, it's kind of really incredibly rewarding. And that's what I'm enjoying about the podcast is, you know, you and I have talked a lot, but this conversation, we haven't. And it's pretty cool. You know, we just kind of always knew it was there, but we haven't said these things, right?
Absolutely. And the gift of who you actually get to interconnect with and have conversations with, and, you know, it's so much fun. It's worth that investment of your time.
Great. Okay. So this week we're talking with Melanie Offenlock, who is probably at her last name often misspelled, who is the Dallas Wine Chick, the famous or infamous Dallas Wine Chick, and been a blogger for 12 years, writing that blog, one of the longest in the industry, I think, short of Alder Yarrow, who we also spoke with a couple of months ago. So I want to thank you, Melanie, for being on the show and also being a friend. And I look forward to seeing you somewhere else in the world sometime soon.
I'm so honored to have been on. It was great to connect with you again.
So, folks, that's Dallas Wine Chick. And do you have any other social media things that you are active on, or is it just the blog?
It's blog, it's Facebook, it's LinkedIn and Twitter, all Dallas Wine Chick.
All Dallas Wine Chick. Okay, great. Okay, thank you, Melanie. And that's it for this week. And I hope you tune in next week where we'll have another fascinating interview with someone I'm just getting to know. Thank you very much. This is Steve Ray signing off for this week.
This is Steve Ray. Thanks again for listening on behalf of the Italian Wine Podcast.